Today at Reader's Corner, Saladin Ambar, author of Malcolm X at Oxford Union, Racial Politics in a Global Era. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. 50 years after he was assassinated, at age 39, Malcolm X remains a controversial and somewhat mysterious figure. During his short but eventful life, he was a minister with the Nation of Islam, who went on to found his own mosque, a fiery militant who advocated any means necessary to attain racial justice, and a brilliant charismatic speaker whose legacy is still being determined. Today's guest, Saladin Ambar, offers insights into how Malcolm X continued to change and refine his philosophy and politics near the end of his life in his book, Malcolm X at Oxford Union. The book offers analysis and context for a speech Malcolm X gave as part of a debate at Oxford University, a speech that, until Dr. Ambar's book, has received very little scrutiny. Dr. Ambar teaches political science at Lehigh University, and he'll be visiting Boise State next week as we mark Black History Month. Dr. Ambar will introduce a screening of the film Malcolm X, starring Denzel Washington, at 6 p.m. on Wednesday in the Special Events Center, and he'll also speak at noon Thursday in the Simplot Ballroom in the Student Union Building. The events are free and open to the public, and you can find out more at boisestate.edu. Dr. Ambar joins us by phone for this interview. Saladin Ambar, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here with you and your entire audience. Thank you.
Well, Saladin, this is an interesting book in that for you it seems to be a bit of a personal journey as well as an academic exercise in the sense that you relate in the book that, as far as you're concerned, you were dramatically affected by the work of Malcolm X. I think at one point you said something like, in word, image, and deed, even your name was affected by Malcolm X. Explain that.
Well, I think, anyone who, certainly New York, but most likely in the northern cities of the United States in the 70s and 80s, who was growing up, had to be impacted by the legacy and life of Malcolm X. He spoke to so many things going on, particularly in urban America. He spoke about the bad education. He spoke about the lack of feeling a sense of pride in oneself. He spoke about the need to address police brutality, which was an issue certainly in New York City in the 1980s for me personally and so many of my friends. He spoke about, parenting, frankly, and what it meant to be a father. And, you know, many of the folks in my neighborhood didn't have in-home dads with them raising them. And so he spoke to also, America and its crimes, frankly, against Black people and those around the world who were oppressed. And, the apartheid movement, the anti-apartheid movement, time fraught with danger with regard to the Soviet Union. And so Malcolm X really highlighted the things in so many of in mine and so many of my friends' lives that were missing and that needed addressing. And he spoke to them quite forcefully. And so in many ways, lots of us emulated him, if not religiously, then aesthetically, trying to dress like him, speak like him, and there's still some of that going on, I would argue today, from the world of hip hop to athletes. He still is very much a cultural force in American life.
Can you describe Malcolm X's public life in the history of mid-20th century America in the context of the civil rights movement? Could you just kind of summarize who he really was in this movement compared to some of the people that folks know a lot more about? Martin Luther King would be the greatest example of that.
Right. Well, it's a great question. He really was the person who came from the nationalist wing of Black political thought. He was someone who was raised in a household where the father had been a devotee and follower of Marcus Garvey, the Back to Africa movement. And of course, Malcolm X was a student of Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam, which was his organization. He was someone who had posited that African-Americans needed to separate from America, if not to a new continent, then within territory designed for Blacks in the United States. And so he came out of the fiercest and most critical wing of black political thought, one that had given up hope on racial justice in America by the American government. And so he comes out of that, frankly, that tradition that goes all the way back to Nat Turner and, you know, Gabriel Prosser and others who revolted. And also he comes out of the wing of Garvey and, you know, men who and women who advocated for a militant break with the United States. And so that opposition situated him in such a way that he could not only strike fear into the hearts of, you know, the American government and people sort of, you know, middle class whites who are, you know, watching him on the news, but also many African-Americans, many black families were, you know, definitely afraid of what Malcolm X represented, because he suggested to them that their sort of, you know, somber, aspirational middle class lives, or at least the ones that they hoped to have, could be pulled out from underneath them at any moment. And he reminded them of that. And so he was not only a feared person among many whites, but also among many blacks. And that made him, I think, in some ways, very helpful to the mainstream civil rights movement leaders, men like Dr. King, who could point to Malcolm X and say, if you, meaning the American government, don't deal justly with black people who are advocating peaceful resistance, peaceful and nonviolent struggle, then we've got some other characters out here that you're going to have to deal with, including this fellow.
Right.
So
right.
It was sort of that inside outside game was, I think, integral to helping the mainstream movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, no matter the color of the skin, there's not many people who drop out of junior high and achieve the greatness, the impact that Malcolm X had. And I want to start our discussion of the speech and all that surrounds it with a couple of questions that I just as I was reading the speech itself, and thank you for putting the speech at the back of the book, by the way, because that was really helpful after reading your book to have a chance to get it in his own words, in entire context. He didn't seem to be reading this speech, and I wonder, did he even write it? Was he working from notes? It's brilliantly delivered, and it looks like this guy's just up there talking extemporaneously, or correct me if I'm wrong on that one.
Well, I mean, yes and no. So, you know, one of the things I learned was going to the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem, reading through Malcolm X's diary. He kept a travel log and diary for much of 1964 when he was made his pilgrimage to Mecca, but also visited Africa and also visited London and Paris and so forth, and ultimately Oxford. In that travel log, that journal, you can see him taking notes about his upcoming speeches. Now, these were not really longhand notes. They were kind of, you know, short, succinct blurbs, if you will, bullet points that he wanted to make. And he would have these bullet points on nationalism, the pros and cons. He would have bullet points about U.S. foreign policy. He would have bullet points about the Civil Rights Act and how it should pass, about the upcoming election in 64. And with those bullet points in mind, he would weave in his own mind a sort of a tapestry that he wanted to create in words that would get to his ultimate points about justice and so forth. And I think some of that training, frankly, that extemporaneous training of thinking quickly on your feet came when he debated in the Norfolk penal colony in Massachusetts, where Cambridge, I believe, and Oxford also had sent debating teams while he was incarcerated before he began his public life. Malcolm X had become an expert debater, and his autobiography referenced his time debating and studying. This is after, of course, he had sort of made a transition in prison to become an educated person, to become someone who was, you know, fascinated by and riveted by history and politics and so forth. And he only continued to hone those skills on the streets of Harlem, but also at many universities. I mean, Malcolm X spoke at Harvard. He spoke, you know, at just about all of the name brand colleges and universities across the country. He had been invited and frequently went to visit and debated folks. So at Oxford, he knew what he wanted to say, and he only had to have sort of these little crib notes that he could just reference from here to there throughout the talk. It was at that point in his life something that was, I think, secondhand for him.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Saladin Ambar, author of Malcolm X at Oxford Union, Racial Politics in a Global Era. Well, I have to admit, your book sent me on a journey. I was just incredibly impressed, so much so that I did a little research on his bio. As I mentioned to you before we started talking on the air, I read the autobiography of Malcolm X back in the 70s, I guess it was, and really don't remember a lot about it, but I decided to go check out his young life. And under the category of trying to understand why people become who they are, I was really surprised to learn that his family, whether it's Omaha, Milwaukee, especially Lansing, Michigan, they were constantly besieged by white supremacists of one kind or another. And I never knew there was such an organization called the Black Legion, which is basically the KKK of the North, that he thinks may have killed his father, I believe. Isn't that correct?
That's absolutely right. And not only that, it was sort of the unofficial terror groups like the Black League or the Klan that besieged his family. But then, as he argued in the autobiography, sort of the institutional bureaucracy of terror that, you know, the American government had long created, that separated Black families who were poor or destitute or indigent. His mom was a woman who reached a psychological breaking point, and they separated the family out, institutionalized her. And I think he says at one point in the autobiography, no greater harm could have been done to a family by violent act or terrorist act than what the U.S. government did to my family in separating us and parceling out the brothers and sisters across the country. And so that had absolutely the loss of his father. By all accounts, there's maybe some shadow of a question there raised by some scholars, but by all accounts, it seems to be that he was, in fact, the victim of the Black Legion, that separation was devastating. And again, speaking to why his story resonates even today, that's not unfamiliar to many Black families around now. The loss and separation of family members, people who are institutionalized or incarcerated and so forth. So, and that's not just a Southern story. In many ways, it's a Northern story.
Tell you what I'd like to do now, if you could, Saladin. Let's start off with Malcolm's name. He was Malcolm Little. He became Malcolm X. Explain to our listeners his rationale there.
Well, you know, it really is owed to the Nation of Islam policy of designating their followers with the letter X, X as their last name, you know, in the mathematical equivalent of the unknown, right, quantity. Given that African Americans had been, for the most part, the vast majority in the country had been descended from enslaved Africans, the logic was that you could never really know your family identity truly. And so X was put in lieu of taking on the slave master's name. In many ways, it was an affirmation of identity beyond that given to Blacks by whites. And so there were many X's in the Nation of Islam. Muhammad Ali, before he became Muhammad Ali, was Cassius Clay, and there had been the thought that he'd be Muhammad X, but Elijah Muhammad gave him the name Muhammad Ali. So that was not unique to Malcolm X. What was unique, I think, was his public persona in making that name, making that signifier X, something that people talked about. I mean, you know, imagine, you know, you're going to be on national television or radio show, as he often was, and my next speaker today is Malcolm X. Well, you know, today we know who Malcolm X is, but, you know, at that time, it was like, who is this guy? It's like an alien. Well, you know, what kind of last name is X, you know? And then he would often be asked about it, and he would have to explain it. And in the explanation, you saw a fire and a fiery rejection of, as you suggested, white supremacy, not just from the standpoint of what is physically done or had physically been done to African Americans, but psychically, the identification with the slave master was as much a problem, Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam had argued for so long, as much of a problem as anything. And that break was important. And it came up at Oxford, by the way. One of the debaters, Humphrey Barclay, sort of mocked Malcolm X's last name and basically suggested that his name had come out of a Kafka play or novel or something. And he got it from Malcolm X at the very beginning of his Oxford address, telling him why he refused to take on the name of the slave master. So, yeah, it's a pretty pretty powerful story.
So set up the Oxford Union debates for us. What were they? Who did the inviting? What did the stage look like? And I shouldn't say stage, the audience. Help us understand what this was like for Malcolm X as he presented himself to this group.
Well, the Oxford Union Society had been sponsoring debates going back to the 1830s, and these debates were on all manner of topics. And that debate hall to this day has photographs and images from debates going back perhaps close to 100 years at this stage. And so it was this time-honored tradition to have speakers talk about controversial subjects, the most controversial subjects imagined. Now, there had been in the early 60s a black man named Anthony Eric Abrahams, who had been president, not the first black president of the Oxford Union Society, but I believe he was the second. And he, exercised his option to invite the speaker for the end of the year term to come and deliver an address as part of the debate. And he had been very much radicalized, Abrahams, from Jamaica originally, by Malcolm X. But no one really knew who he was, Malcolm X. And so he, Tony, if you want to invite him, go ahead, bring him. And the subject for the debate was Barry Goldwater's famous or infamous line from the 1964 Republican convention: extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue. Now, that rather eloquent line from Cicero, of all people, was seen as a bouquet thrown by Goldwater to the most racist forces in American life, including the White Citizens Council, the Ku Klux Klan, the John Birch Society, and what have you. And so Eisenhower, in fact, admonished Goldwater for making that line about extremism sort of be the identifier for the Republican convention. The short of it was, Abrahams thought, who better to speak to this idea of extremism than Malcolm X? And so he invited Malcolm, and this was an interesting period for Malcolm X, because in the latter part of 1964, he was looking to expand his religious and political organization, really the Organization for Afro-American Unity, into cities not only in Africa, the Middle East, but in Europe. And he had made some headway in London and in Paris and was looking at Amsterdam. And the ability to speak to the Oxford Union with the megaphone, the extraordinary megaphone of the BBC, which had agreed to broadcast the event that night, gave him a kind of unfiltered and unvarnished opportunity to present his ideas before millions of people. And it became something that he was very excited to do.
Do I remember that the BBC really didn't end up broadcasting the entire episode?
That is correct. What they did do, and I think it was shrewd in its own way on their part, was they spliced into Malcolm X in his speech and debate sort of presentation midpoint. Even now, if you look on YouTube, it's one of the reasons why you have to listen to the audio completely, or I would prefer you to read my book and then read the speech in its entirety.
Right.
The truth of the matter is you can only see half of Malcolm X's speech because the BBC interrupts him. And they do so at a point where where you think he's being fiery and whatnot. But one of the things viewers and listeners and readers of the speech will pick up on, I hope readers of the book will pick up on, was Malcolm X's use of humor. Not only in that debate moment in speech, but in so many of his public presentations. For all of the a reality of his anger and sort of righteous indignation about black suffering. He was also quite funny and quite extraordinary in his use of humor, and he exercised it at Oxford most skillfully. And so, yes, the BBC had some difficulty, I think, with the images because there were, you know, this packed audience, rafters filled of folks, including a good number of students of color who Oxford was just admitting at that point. All of a sudden, in uproarious laughter about what Malcolm X was saying, you can see them in the audience and hear the accounts. And I've interviewed a few people who were at the debate talking about how, intense the audience was, but also how laid back they were and sort of at home with him because he, in fact, laced his speech with lots of humor throughout.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Saladin Ambar about his book Malcolm X at Oxford Union, which looks at a speech Malcolm X gave at Oxford University a couple months before his death. Well, help us understand why Britain, and maybe even the BBC in particular, since it is government TV, was a bit nervous about Malcolm X speaking in Britain. After all, he wasn't there to just talk about racism in America. He was there to talk about colonialization, its impact on minorities across the world. Please.
Sure. Well, one of the things I was drawn to about the speech was the fact that in 1964, not only was there an American election, but there was a major national election in the UK. And for the first time, race had been really front and center. Questions about immigration and who could be English, who ought to be perceived as English, who couldn't be seen as English, and so forth. What does it mean to be a Brit, right, in the mid-60s as Jamaicans and Trinidadians and others from the colonial empire that is now being lost start to move in and seek housing and education and the rest of it. This was a very controversial moment because during that election, the conservative member of parliament who was seeking to become prime minister, seeking office as an MP, was riddled by criticism nationally and in the press for having supported a statement that began to appear on placards and posters and graffiti around the town of Smethwick, England. And the statement was, "If you want a nigger neighbor, vote Labour." Your listeners will excuse me for saying it, but that is what was said. And that is a statement that he refused to denounce. He would not denounce it, saying it was a true expression of the people of England. Well, it was highly controversial. Peter Griffith, I believe was his name, who ran for that office. Very incendiary. How do you go from that kind of country to a country that all of a sudden now is being tasked with embracing Pakistanis, Indians, Jamaicans, Africans, North Africans, and the rest, coming into your country and saying, we want to be a part of the Commonwealth. We want to be as English as the next person, at least with respect to rights and the basic dignities afforded to human beings in this country. And so now you have Malcolm X coming to Oxford of all places. It was quite a fireball, and it was quite something. But in part, it was quite something because whatever people had heard about Malcolm X, they knew he was controversial and scary, but they also knew that something scary was happening in their own country. There had been a 1959 Nottingham riot. There had been a sense that the immigrant swamping of England, if I could paraphrase Margaret Thatcher's later comments about immigration, the feeling of being swamped, that was taking place in the 60s. And what did Malcolm X have to say about that? You can imagine how tense things were. And so he was wise, I think, to begin his speech with an opening line that was actually quite funny. And it sort of settled the audience down and got them to look at him not as a monster or as some symbol, but as a human being.
Boy, your response is like Back to the Future when it comes to how this plays out today. And, of course, Boiseans will have the opportunity to hear more about that because that will be the subject of one of your addresses, which I'll remind people of again when we finish the interview here. And in the intro, I mentioned that Malcolm X advocated, and I had it in quotes on my sheet, any means necessary to attain racial justice. And the reason I had it in quotes is because that's a very nuanced statement, and I want to give you an opportunity to explain just how that plays out in Malcolm's life and how he feels about that and his reasoning as far as pacifism is concerned as well.
Sure. I think Malcolm X saw the movement in America of black people for what we have called civil rights as an issue of human rights. And he tried to extend that connection to the international struggle for decolonization and racial justice globally. And he thought in revolutionary terms, and he thought that there was had been no revolution, as he had argued in so many places, most famously in another of his speeches, Message to the Grassroots, that, you know, revolution could well be violent. There hadn't really been nonviolent revolutions. And he would hold the American experience up as a mirror before the United States and say, well, and in fact, he did at Oxford, you know, you say, give me liberty or give me death. That's very militant. That's very violent. It's an extreme statement. As he quoted Patrick Henry to his laughing British audience. The big point he made, I think, was really under ordinary circumstances, and by ordinary I mean when uttered by whites, really something not very controversial at all. The right of self-defense, the right of people to raise up against their oppressors. You know, for us as Americans, not unusual. I think Malcolm X wanted us to know that what is unusual is not that the idea that any means necessary is controversial or unusual. It's just the idea that in the hands of black people, it becomes frightening. You know, he was frequently one to cite, or he often, I should say, cited, you know, the American Revolutionary experience of looking at the founding fathers and Jefferson and others who had taken up arms against the British and weren't asked to do so nonviolently. He liked that ambiguity because it suggested that blacks had a right to, if necessary, raise up violently against their oppressors. Certainly a right to self-defense. Now, obviously, that could have met odds with King and so many in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the Civil Rights Movement and so forth. But it was an effort on his part to say, this is an issue of human rights, and if whites have the right, if people have a right to raise up against, you know, oppression around the world who are white, why can't we? And it was a powerful, in many ways, I argue in the book, a liberal argument out of John Locke, out of Jefferson, that people, you know, when in the course of human events have are mistreated, they have a right to recourse. And even though he himself had not been violent in his public life whatsoever, that image was powerful enough to forever ensconce that image of him in the public mind as a violent and fearsome individual, when in fact he was advocating a basic right that I think whites, frankly, have long taken for granted.
So Malcolm X lived only 80 days after the Oxford Union speech. He was assassinated. Do we know who did it? Did the Nation of Islam take credit for it? I don't remember enough of history to know exactly how this all plays out.
Right. Well, the short answer is we may know at least one of the individuals who did it, but there's been some controversy about whether or not others who had been incarcerated or imprisoned for that crime were the individuals. I think it's fair to say that at a minimum, the Nation of Islam created an incendiary and violent atmosphere around the assassination of Malcolm X. And I think it's also fair to say that they were in some ways participants in it. I think there is, in short, no definitive answer about all of the figures who were involved in Malcolm X's assassination. The degree to which, frankly, the New York City Police Department, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, was complicit, if not in certainly pulling the trigger, but in creating an environment in which that assassination could take place. Well, those are open questions, ones that scholars and researchers are continuing to go back to over and over again.
Saladin, we are out of time, but look forward to joining you here in Boise during your visit next week. Thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Really appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Again, next week, Dr. Ambar will be visiting Boise State. He will be presenting a lecture and also introducing a screening of the film Malcolm X, starring Denzel Washington. You can find out details at boisestate.edu. Next week, Peter Bergen, author of The United States of Jihad, Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.